Good morning. The CIA says Saudi leader Mohammed bin Salman approved murdering a journalist. As MBS visits the White House, a former colleague of Jamal Khashoggi says the meeting is a costly mistake for the U.S. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene used to be one of Trump's loudest allies. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Now she says the president is falling short of his own agenda. What does that show about Trump's coalition? Also, the Warner Brothers Discovery Film Studio is up for sale, and we see renewable energy from two sides of the Pacific. One reporter is in California, the other in China. It's Tuesday, November 18th. This day in 1963, the Bell Company released its first push-button telephone. The screen and the phone came later. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump is hosting the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia today at the White House. NPR's Franco Ordonez reports it's the first visit since the murder of a journalist at a Saudi consulate 7 years ago.
Just before Prince Mohammed bin Salman arrived, President Trump announced that the U.S. would be selling F-35 fighter jets to Saudi Arabia, which is in itself a controversial move as it could change the military balance in the Middle East. The Crown Prince's visit marks a significant step towards his efforts to restore his global credibility after the 2018 killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. U.S. intelligence determined that the prince had approved the assassination. The president and prince are also expected to discuss security agreements and efforts to normalize relations with Israel. Franco Ordonez, NPR News, the White House.
The UN Security Council has adopted a resolution on Gaza. It authorizes an international force to go there for the next 2 years. One goal is to disarm Hamas. Hamas opposes this. Language in the resolution calls for a potential path to Palestinian statehood. Israeli leaders say they will never agree to that. The House of Representatives is preparing to take up a measure involving late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. This would force the Justice Department to publicize any files related to him. NPR's Barbara Sprunt reports this comes as President Trump did an about-face on the measure itself.
Over the weekend, President Trump encouraged House Republicans to support a measure that would release all unclassified files related to Jeffrey Epstein, who died by suicide in 2019 while awaiting trial on sex trafficking charges. That's a major reversal for the president, who's been encouraging Republicans to drop the matter. The administration has already released thousands of files to the House Oversight Committee, but there remain even more that haven't been made public. Should the House pass the measure, its fate is still not clear in the Senate. If it passes both chambers, the president says he'll sign it. Barbara Sprint, NPR News, the Capitol.
Federal immigration officials are expanding their enforcement in North Carolina. Border Patrol agents have been deployed in the city of Charlotte. Now, the Democratic mayor of Raleigh says she expects federal agents to launch operations in her city as soon as today. NPR's Giles Snyder has more.
Raleigh Mayor Janet Cowell says it's not clear how large the enforcement surge will be, but in a statement she said public safety is a priority for the city, and she asked Raleigh residents to remember their values and maintain peace and respect through any upcoming challenges. The attention on Raleigh comes after federal officials said Border Patrol agents had arrested more than 130 people over the weekend in Charlotte, North Carolina's largest city.
NPR's Giles Snyder prepared that report. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. In Maryland, transit officials say it will take twice as much money to rebuild the collapsed Key Bridge. The new cost projection is at least $4.3 billion to more than $5 billion. The Baltimore Bridge fell apart when it was hit by a cargo ship in March last year. Six people were killed. Federal safety officials are holding a meeting about the Key Bridge today. The nation's third largest owner of local TV stations is making a bid to take over one of its competitors. From member station WVXU in Cincinnati, Tana Weingartner reports Sinclair Broadcasting has announced it wants to try to acquire rival Scripps based in Cincinnati.
In a filing, Baltimore-based Sinclair says it's bought an 8.2% stake in Scripps and that a merger could be done within a year. Cincinnati media reporter John Keysweater, however, notes Scripps issued a statement saying it would take steps to protect the company from the opportunistic actions of Sinclair or anyone else.
Calling it an opportunistic action doesn't sound like Scripps and Sinclair are all that close to coming to a deal, even though Sinclair is saying, you know, they've been talking for months about combining forces.
The FCC is already mulling a multi-billion dollar deal by the nation's largest TV station owner, Nexstar, to take over its competitor, Tegna. For NPR News, I'm Tana Weingartner in Cincinnati.
The head of the Federal Emergency Management Agency is quitting. David Richardson had been on the job for just 6 months. He'd been criticized by lawmakers for being aloof during deadly flooding this summer in Texas. You're listening to NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include MS Now, home to The Rachel Maddow Show, Morning Joe, The Briefing with Jen Psaki, and more. MS Now is a source for news, opinion, and the world. Learn more at ms.now. This is NPR.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 seconds.
November 18th, 1977. Opening day of the four-day National Women's Conference. And Bonnie Wallace had made the trip all the way from Minnesota only to stand in line. Houston, Texas, the host city for this first ever federally funded women's conference, was overwhelmed by the influx of women, as many as 20,000 of them. Wallace, an enrolled member of the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa, was in line at a Houston hotel, overbooked like every other hotel in the city. And when it was her turn to talk to the clerk, she got some bad news. The hotel had no meeting room set aside for Wallace's American Indian Women's Caucus. In fact, the hotel didn't even know they were coming. Every caucus and special interest group was supposed to have a room to meet in. Now there were no rooms to be had. But finally, a solution was hit upon. Bonnie Wallace and the other members of the American Indian Women's Caucus agreed upon the resolutions they would submit to the conference as a whole. In the lounge of the hotel's women's restroom, with the background ambiance of flushing toilets.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And May Martinez in Los Angeles, California. President Trump hosts Saudi Arabia's crown prince at the White House today.
They lead nations with a lot of shared history. The U.S. and Saudi Arabia have been allies since President Franklin Roosevelt was in the region and met Saudi Arabia's king in 1945. The Saudis provided oil, the U.S. often provided security, and the royal family enjoyed personal connections to presidents.
Then there's more recent history. The U.S. found the Saudis killed a Washington Post columnist during Trump's first term. In a moment, we'll hear from a friend of that columnist. We begin with today's agenda, a meeting where the president and Mohammed bin Salman plan to announce deals.
NPR's Aya Batraoui is based in the Gulf, has been following the crown prince and other matters. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Okay, so what are the two leaders expecting to announce and discuss?
Well, the biggest deal that's being eyed right now by Prince Mohammed bin Salman isn't actually more billions in weapons sales. He has enough of those. What he wants is a U.S. guarantee against a range of threats in the region, and that means a coveted U.S. defense pact similar to the one Trump signed with Qatar recently after it was attacked by both Iran and Israel over the summer. And this is not a defense treaty, so it doesn't need Congress to approve it, and it is less binding. But it does offer Saudi Arabia guarantees that the U.S. would use military measures if necessary to respond if it's attacked. That did not happen under Trump's first term when Saudi oil facilities were bombed by Iranian missiles and drones from Yemen. Now, another deal being eyed is a defense deal, but it's unlike any before. The Crown Prince wants advanced F-35 jets that currently only Israel flies in the Mideast. And the Saudis also want a U.S. civilian nuclear technology transfer and advanced AI chips. And for all of this, Steve, the prince says he's ready to invest $600 billion or more into the U.S. under Trump.
Okay, big dollar figure. I'm reminded, though, all politics is local and often foreign policy is domestic policy. What are the domestic calculations of each of these leaders?
Okay, this visit is important for both. First of all, it gives Trump a chance to turn those headlines away from the Jeffrey Epstein emails and the challenges within his own party over that to multi-billion-dollar investments that he says create jobs in the U.S. and herald the U.S. return of global superiority over China and Russia, you know, the MAGA message. Now, for the prince, This is a turning point. It is his first time back in Washington since 2018 when that Saudi critic and Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi was killed by the prince's aides in an operation that the CIA says he approved. The crown prince, also known as MBS, has denied that. And there is a continued clampdown on perceived critics in the kingdom, including travel bans that are still imposed on women's rights activists. But he is a popular leader among young Saudis. Steve, I was just in Saudi last month speaking with Saudis of all ages, and they say there are soaring rents in Riyadh right now, and that's worrying to them. But they say he has transformed the country, and he's turning Riyadh into a kind of global city like Dubai, with plans to host the World Expo and the FIFA World Cup. But he's going to need companies to also invest in Saudi Arabia, too, to create jobs for Saudis and to keep pace with these massive reforms.
I'm thinking about the way the president makes diplomacy personal. It's about him and the other leader. You can picture him saying, look, Crown Prince, here's where I'm building my ballroom. What's the relationship like?
Yes, you know, the president has leaned on those ties with Gulf Arab rulers in particular for a range of issues like his Gaza ceasefire plan and the 20-point peace plan right now. But there are also billions of dollars, meanwhile, you know, from Gulf money flowing into his family's business ventures. And that includes Trump-branded golf courses and towers being built in Saudi Arabia and across the Gulf by a Saudi developer. Now, the White House says that and other business deals are not a conflict of interest and that the president gave up a life of luxury for public service. But analysts that I've spoken to in the Gulf say, you know, the leaders in this region are simply leveraging a transactional relationship while Trump's in office. And they know very well that election cycles can bring a change in mood in Washington on a dime.
NPR international correspondent Aya Batraoui in Dubai. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Steve.
For more on Trump's meeting today with Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, we've called up Jason Rezaian. He is the director of Press Freedom Initiatives at the Washington Post, the paper where Jamal Khashoggi was a columnist when, according to a U.S. intelligence report, he was murdered in an operation approved by bin Salman. Jason, you wrote an opinion for the Washington Post where you described this visit as a costly mistake. What is that cost?
I think it's a mistake for the United States to greenlight the type of behavior that Mohammed bin Salman has been guilty of multiple times. It's a signal to friends and foes alike that you can literally get away with murder if you're the right kind of partner to the United States.
Is it maybe more of a moral mistake as opposed to maybe a different kind of mistake? Because Saudi Arabia is so entrenched in world economics and finance and considering what they produce for the world that, you know, is it maybe more that than anything else?
I think, you know, first and foremost, yes, it's a moral mistake. But we are the United States of America. We are still, the last time I checked, the leading superpower, and Saudi Arabia is not on par with us. This is a client state. When you have that sort of relationship with smaller countries, even if they possess massive amounts of critically important natural resources and maybe arguably, you know, the most important natural resource, they don't get to dictate the terms of the relationship. We've allowed that to happen in this case, and this young man who has amassed incredible power in a short period of time and wielded it recklessly, irresponsibly, and murderously, if our own intelligence community is to be believed, that's problematic, not just on a moral level, but on a strategic and geopolitical one as well.
President Trump has not believed the United States intelligence in other cases, too, with Vladimir Putin is another example that stands out. When it comes to this particular relationship, is there any way that once President Trump is no longer in office that the United States can maybe reset the relationship?
There was certainly an opportunity to reset it during the Biden administration, and President Biden chose not to do that. So I think, yes, there's always an opportunity to reset relations and change the course of relations with any country. But in the case of Saudi Arabia, that has not happened. And I and my colleagues at The Washington Post will continue to remind you that one of our colleagues in the not-so-distant past was murdered. And the U.S. intelligence community believes that he was murdered by order of Mohammed bin Salman. And that's not something that we can just kind of wipe under the rug or forget about.
You met bin Salman when he talked with the Washington Post's editorial board. That was back in 2018, which was 6 months before the disappearance and murder of Khashoggi. What was your takeaway from him back then?
Well, it was an off-the-record setting, so I won't go into too many details. But, you know, I was struck by his lack of humility, his apparent willingness to lie about things that were easily debunkable. And I think this potential for a lot of hubris, a lot of people in the room in Washington and in the United States were charmed by this young, English-speaking, affable prince. But none of those attributes can really undo the incredible damage that has been done on his watch.
Now, you end your piece in the Washington Post by writing, quote, "We will be dealing with this decision's fallout for a long time." How so?
Mohammed bin Salman is 40 years old. He got Saudi Arabia into a protracted conflict with Yemen that was not something that they got out of very easily. He's courted conflict with Iran, and every time comes to the United States asking, begging for more help. If that's the kind of relationship this is going to be, we'll be cleaning up messes left and right for a long time, because in all likelihood, he'll be around for the better part of the next half century.
Jason Rezaian is the director of Press Freedom Initiatives at the Washington Post and the paper's former correspondent in Tehran. Jason, thank you very much for your thoughts on this.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
The Saudi government has previously denied the U.S. intelligence finding and said it took, quote, all necessary judicial measures to prosecute the murderers of Jamal Khashoggi.
There's a lot of world news today that involves the United States. Here's another item. The United Nations Security Council authorized an international peacekeeping force for Gaza and a U.S. plan for the territory. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
U.S. Ambassador Mike Waltz describes Gaza as a crucible of conflict.
A hell on earth, where Hamas's brutality and terror met Israel's fierce response.
But he says the Security Council resolution that passed in a 13-0 vote could help chart a new course, and President Trump will be playing a big role in that.
The Board of Peace, which will be led by President Trump, remains the cornerstone of our effort. The board will coordinate the delivery of humanitarian assistance, facilitate Gaza's development, and support a technocratic committee of Palestinians responsible for day-to-day operations.
The resolution also authorizes an international stabilization force until December of 2027. Waltz says he expects peacekeepers will come from mostly Muslim-majority nations. Algeria's ambassador, Amar Benjema, calls that a major development and says the force must protect Palestinian civilians and enable the complete withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza. He points to some of the language that convinced his country to vote yes.
It clearly affirms no annexation, no occupation, no forced displacement.
The Security Council resolution only alludes to the possibility of a pathway to Palestinian statehood. Russia's ambassador, Vasily Nebenzia, had proposed a different draft, but backed down and abstained in the vote, along with China.
Главное, чтобы этот документ не стал ширмой.
Nebenzia says the main thing is that this document should not become a smokescreen for what he calls unbridled experiments by the U.S. and Israel in controlling Gaza, and that this does not become the death knell of a two-state solution. Hamas rejected what it called an international trusteeship that's being imposed on the Gaza Strip and said an international force should be neutral and not turned into a party to the conflict. Israel's ambassador says his country will make sure that Hamas is demilitarized and no longer poses a threat. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
This is NPR News. Thank you.
I'm Heidi Holton. We're excited at KEXC to be bringing you more jazz programming with our volunteer, Paul Kivi, the history of jazz.
Well, I think this is some of the finest music ever made, and it's kind of gotten lost across time. I pick the songs that I love, and there's lots of them, and there's lots to love. The popular music in the late 20s and 30s, especially the 30s and 40s with the big band era, that was jazz. That was the one period of time when jazz was popular music. And so you're going to hear a lot of things that are easy to get into. If you develop a taste for it, then the stuff that happens starting with Charlie Parker in the late 1940s makes sense.
Hear the history of jazz on KAXC with Paul Kivi, Saturdays at noon and Sundays at 4.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs. With online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. And from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. World leaders have gathered in Brazil for the UN Climate Conference. The U.S. is not there, but China is. When it comes to energy transition, the U.S. and China couldn't be on more different paths. China is moving away from fossil fuels while the U.S. is doubling down. Experts say this will have consequences for the climate and these countries' economies. NPR sent two correspondents to opposite sides of the Pacific to learn more. We begin with NPR's Julia Simon in Eureka, California.
In far northern California, Chris Mickelson drives an old police cruiser past little wooden houses.
Pine trees with moss just like hanging off of them.
Just an old seaside town.
Mickelson is the executive director of the Humboldt Bay Harbor District, which plans to assemble wind turbines for a massive new offshore wind project. About 20 miles off this misty coast, two companies, American Vineyard Offshore and German RWE, plan to build turbines to power more than 2 million homes. Mickelson says the project aims to make about 270 long-term local jobs.
It's going to change the economic viability of our community, and my voice gets a little shaky because it's going to make a better opportunity for our kids.
Yeah.
That's pretty important.
The new terminal was supposed to be shovel ready as soon as 2026, Mickelson says. That's no longer realistic, in part because the Trump administration recently canceled more than $426 million in federal grants for the project. Mickelson says it's been pencils down since then as they try to find new sources of money. This is one of dozens of actions this administration has taken to starve the renewable energy industry of federal support, from canceling tax credits years early to issuing stop work orders. Amanda Levin at the nonprofit Natural Resources Defense Council says the U.S. renewable industry had been growing.
For the first time last year, wind and solar produced more electricity than coal. Things were headed in the right direction, but this really just takes the wind out of their sails.
The Trump administration is reversing support for renewables, which it incorrectly labels as risky and unreliable. But across the Pacific Ocean, America's biggest competitor, China, thinks otherwise. Let's throw the mic 5,000 miles to NPR's Anthony Kuhn, who's there.
You are right, Julia. Here in China, renewable isn't a dirty word. China's leadership has made strategic choices to include renewables in its energy mix. We're in China's Zhangbei region, which is in between the capital, Beijing, and the edge of the Mongolian plateau. The area is rich in wind resources, and it's where a lot of China's wind and solar capacity is being installed. turbine blades swoosh past in huge circles. The electricity goes from here to a grid outside Beijing and on to the rest of China. China now dominates the global renewables sector. In the first half of this year, China built more solar than the rest of the world combined. 74% of all large-scale wind and solar projects are being built in China. Compare that to the U.S. that's building 6%. China now has more installed generation capacity from solar and wind than from gas and coal. It wasn't always this way. Until recently, China's economic growth came at the cost of air pollution from burning fossil fuels. But in the last few decades, authorities in Beijing began to consider a sustainable economic growth model, and renewables have been a key part of that. According to Qin Haiyan, director of the parent company of the wind farm we visited, and vice president of the World Wind Energy Association.
Developing the economy and reducing carbon emissions to address climate change are now no longer contradictory.
And this, according to the Asia Society's Li Shuo, is the biggest difference between the U.S. and China in climate policy today.
It couldn't be a stronger contrast between the two countries.
In China, solar and wind are now cheaper than coal and gas. Li Shuo says one of the most dramatic aspects of China's climate story is not just that they seem to be cutting their climate emissions,
but also to what extent other parts of the world can also benefit from China's low carbon products.
So China is now exporting turbines and solar panels and batteries around the world, from Brazil to Nigeria to Pakistan.
That's right, Julia. All the renewables growth, both local and exports, is a bright spot amid China's slowing economy, especially its slumping real estate sector. David Fishman is a principal at the Lantau Group in Shanghai.
People who used to be swinging hammers building commercial real estate are now swinging hammers installing solar panels. And that, well, yes, of course you double, triple down on that.
Back in Eureka, Mickelson walks along a creaky dock, an abandoned pulp mill looming behind us. He says he doesn't understand why the Trump administration would cancel the grants for the terminal supporting the wind project. He says this community has been suffering since 2008 when the pulp mill closed.
Our administration that was recently elected, not only at the presidential level, but even some of our Congress and senators really ran on a platform that we're going to build back America, that we're going to create jobs in rural America, good, skilled, trained, you know, high paying jobs. And there's no better place. You're looking around, you're seeing the remnants of what once was.
It is still unclear what the nationwide cuts to renewable energy mean for U.S. climate emissions.
But in China, the climate story is more clear, and it's a rare encouraging indicator in the global warming story. The growth of renewable energy means that China's emissions seem to be on track to peak or are nearing their peak, Li Shuo says. And China's renewable exports mean the country is helping other countries reduce their emissions, too.
Jeremy Wallace, professor at Johns Hopkins University, says now, at the end of the day,
what America does is part of a story, and it is not the main part of the story. It's a cute side character.
China, he says, is now the main character in the story of fighting climate change. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Zhangbei County, Hebei Province, China.
Julia Simon, NPR News, Eureka, California.
The Natural Resources Defense Council is one of NPR's sponsors, and we cover it as we would any other organization. This is NPR News.
The U.S. needs more truck drivers. Could updates to trucks, like cameras and driver assist technology, make long hauls more comfortable and keep drivers around for longer?
I would say that this truck's easier to drive than most cars nowadays.
I'm Scott Detrow. We lift up the hood on the future of trucking on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered is coming up this afternoon at 4 o'clock here on People Powered, KAXE. I'm Heidi Holton with John Latimer. We've got your daily dose of phenology coming up next. Weather around our region looks like it's going to be a sunny day with highs in the low to mid 40s, overnight lows in the mid to upper 20s. Tomorrow, Wednesday, looks cloudy, highs near 40 to 42 degrees. Our question of the week, we have a new Season Watch podcast and where it explores nature as the seasons change. We're asking you, how do you change when fall turns to winter? Does that mean you are putting your sweaters in the dresser? Does it mean that you're making different foods, that you're starting to think ahead to the holidays and decorate? Text us to 1-8-326-1234. KEXE was chosen for Newsmatch 2025. It's a national campaign supporting local nonprofit newsrooms like ours. You helped us get here, and now your gift can go even further. We have over $35,000 in matching funds to support strong local journalism across northern Minnesota. Your gift will be matched 3-1, up to $1,000, while the funds remain. The campaign runs through the end of the year. You can give now at KAXE.org. Our thanks goes out to our business supporters, and that includes the Grand Rapids Area Community Foundation, playing a vital role in connecting charitable intentions with community needs, awarding $30 million in grants and scholarships over the past 30 years to make a lasting impact in our area. More information at gracf.org. Coming up next, John Latimer and our daily dose of nature from him. And tune in as we bring you student phenology reports from across the state of Minnesota and John's full phenology at 7:20.
On today's date, November 18th, in the year 2009, local birder Sean Conrad reports spotting a red-headed woodpecker in the Horseshoe Lake area of Grand Rapids. I talked with Mike and Sue North in the Brainerd area, and Mike has reported red-headed woodpeckers overwintering in the Brainerd area as well. The red-headed woodpecker used to be much more prevalent than they are now. They preferred those brushy, kind of cleared-out areas. Imagine if you ran a herd of cows in a pasture that had more trees than otherwise. And the cows would chew down the grass in between the bushes and the trees, and the red-headed woodpeckers liked that kind of territory. And they were quite prevalent when just about everybody who lived in the countryside had a cow or two, and a lot of them ran pastures that were hardly what you would think of as a pasture, mostly a woodlot with cows running loose in it. And that was preferable to the red-headed woodpeckers. Nowadays, most red-headed woodpeckers are finding homes near golf courses.
Two people in the car were killed. I'm Dave Mattingly.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from Your Part-Time Controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. YPTC.com/NPR. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Okay, so how did one of the president's devoted allies in Congress become a critic?
Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene has questioned Trump's approach to foreign and domestic policy. Now, part of her disagreement grows out of the Epstein files. She objected after the Justice Department decided not to release them, but her differences are broader than that. The president calls Greene, quote, a traitor. Greene says it's Trump who has betrayed the agenda he ran on.
NPR's Stephen Fowler is here to explain this. Hey there, Stephen.
Good morning.
Okay, so she rose as a huge Trump supporter. What happened?
Well, for the last 5 years, Trump and Greene have had one of the strongest relationships on Capitol Hill, but every relationship has its ups and downs. In this moment, Trump campaigned on releasing all of the Department of Justice files pertaining to Epstein to uncover what some call a vast conspiracy about powerful figures in government hiding the truth about child sex abuse. But this year, Trump has done the opposite. He's stonewalled the release and insulted Republicans who want more information, leaving some MAGA conservatives unhappy with certain aspects of his presidency so far.
Oh, this is interesting. You just spoke in the plural, MAGA conservatives. Is Greene expressing something broader in Trump's base?
Well, there have been several instances where some on the right say the president hasn't delivered on domestic priorities that make America great again. And for almost every instance, there's Marjorie Taylor Greene articulating that disconnect. Like in June, when the U.S. bombed Iran, she went on Steve Bannon's War Room show.
6 months in, Steve, and here we are, turning back on the campaign promises, and we bombed Iran on behalf of Israel.
In August, she called Israel's war in Gaza a genocide, has questioned the effectiveness of mass deportations and trade wars, and has been one of the few Republicans in Congress to say that Trump might not always be right.
Well, what has the president said about her?
Over the last few weeks, Steve, there were signs that Trump would eventually lash out online and basically disown her politically. He said this last week in the Oval Office.
I don't know what happened to Marjorie. She's a nice woman, but I don't know what happened. She's lost her way, I think.
But as we mentioned, Greene is not the only Republican wondering if it's Trump who's lost his way. Here's what Greene said in a CNN interview Sunday.
I think that the American people deserve to be put first. That's what Make America Great Again meant to me. And I think that President Trump can do that if he refocuses his effort.
I'm remembering a very different politician when she ran for Congress in Georgia in 2020, and you were around. Is this a big change in her politics?
This is important to reiterate, Steve. Marjorie Taylor Greene has remained ideologically consistent from day one. Unlike others who've criticized Trump and moved away from the Republican Party, Marjorie Taylor Greene is still one of the most conservative members of Congress. At last year's Republican National Convention, she called Trump the, quote, founding father of the America First movement. Now what you're seeing is the assertion that founding father does not equal sole arbiter of what that movement looks like.
What does that suggest, then, for the movement in the future?
Trump has dominated the Republican Party for a decade by creating a big tent of different and sometimes conflicting ideological groups.
Sure.
And getting them to agree to his views and priorities or else. That's starting to change, especially as Trump faces record unpopularity and continues to break with his base's idea of conservatism. There's always going to be this question of what a post-Trump GOP looks like, but Marjorie Taylor Greene is forcing Republicans to confront that question much earlier than they'd planned and with much less certainty about the possible directions.
NPR's Stephen Fowler, thanks so much, sir.
Thank you.
Warner Brothers Discovery is up for sale. The legendary film studio, which has grown into streaming services and cable channels, is accepting bids until this Thursday, according to reports. It's become something of a parlor game, though, to guess who will ultimately buy the house that Jack Warner built. And theater owners are watching closely. Here's NPR's Manuelita del Barco.
Warner Brothers has been in business since 1923, founded by four brothers, Harry, Albert, Sam, and Jack Warner. They owned a movie theater in Pennsylvania before coming to Hollywood to make movies. Warner Brothers Pictures found one of its first silent picture stars in a German shepherd named Rin Tin Tin.
Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
And in 1927, the studio made history with its feature-length talkie picture, The Jazz Singer, starring Al Jolson.
Goodbye.
Over the years, Warner Brothers has made so many iconic films, including Casablanca.
He's looking at you, kid.
From 2001, A Space Odyssey, to Barbie, to all those Looney Tunes cartoons.
What's up, Jack?
Over the decades, Warner Brothers had several owners. 3 years ago, Warner Media, as it was called, merged with Discovery. And last June, the company announced it would split into two, with film, TV, and streaming studios on one side, and on the other side, mostly legacy cable channels, including CNN. The split hasn't happened, and a new buyer might get the entirety of Warner Brothers Discovery. As the film industry continues to consolidate, there's speculation that Warner Brothers' old rival Paramount could take over. Having just merged as Paramount Skydance, CEO David Ellison has already made several overtures. The idea of streaming giant Netflix buying the company has raised antitrust concerns on Capitol Hill. Industry watchers suggest other suitors could be Comcast, Amazon, or an investor who's not already in the entertainment business. Regardless of whoever does end up buying the company, theater owners say they hope they'll prioritize making movies for the cinemas.
As long as we have more movies, that doesn't mean the same amount, that doesn't mean less, but more movies, I think you're going to find folks in the movie theater industry support any business decision that gets us there.
That's Daniel Luria, Senior Vice President at the box office company, which analyzes data from studios and theaters. He says when Disney purchased Fox and Fox Searchlight, their combined studios significantly reduced the number of films they released in the theaters. That's a problem for theater owners who've been struggling to bring audiences back to cinemas after the COVID-19 pandemic shut them down. They're competing with movie watching on TVs, computers, and cell phones. And some fear studios will only greenlight a few big-budget blockbusters. Max Friend is the CEO of FilmBot, the ticketing platform for independent cinemas in the U.S.
The concern is that we're going to see less of that risk-taking, less of that experimentation, and less of that embracing new directors, new filmmakers in the future. And it's really important that there are studios that are funding and supporting, cultivating that kind of work.
Friend points out that this year, Warner Brothers made a string of critical hits, including Ryan Coogler's Sinners, the horror film Weapons, and Paul Thomas Anderson's One Battle After Another. He wonders if the next owner will take similar risks with original creative films. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News, Los Angeles.
Somebody take me in your arms.
We'll note that Warner Brothers, CNN, Disney, Amazon, Comcast, Oracle, 20th Century Studios, and Paramount are NPR sponsors, but we cover them as we would any other company.
Somebody take me in your arms tonight. I hope you can stand it. Stand it all.
This is NPR News.
This is People Powered KAXC, where you get deep dives into the nature of northern Minnesota. And sometimes you get some advice.
As the season of fall is coming to a close, please consider not getting rid of all your leaves that have fallen in your yard. Leaves that litter our yards provide hiding spaces and insulation in the winter for insects and a host of small animals. Also in the spring, leaves start breaking down, releasing nitrogen and other nutrients back into the soil, making a natural fertilizer. This concludes the Phenology Report. Have a great week and be observant.
You can learn and stay curious by listening to the brand new Season Watch podcast featuring the voices of students across the region and Charlie Mitchell and John Latimer. Go to KEXC.org or Spotify or Apple to sign up for the Season Watch podcast. It's 5:43. Thanks for tuning in to the Tuesday morning show. We've got more coming up from Morning Edition and National Public Radio. Northern Community Radio's Board of Directors meets at 6 p.m. Monday, November 24th at KAXC in Grand Rapids and on Zoom. This is an open meeting. Members and the general public are invited to attend. For more information, email comments at kexc.org or call 218-326-1234 during business hours. Regular meetings of our board of directors are held the fourth Monday of the month. The board's meeting schedule is at kaxe.org. Some things going on around our region. Today from 4 to 6 at the Park Rapids City Hall, the Minnesota Department of Transportation is holding an open house. It is about the Highway 34 corridor study. And you can take part in a community read-in at the Bemidji Public Library from 5 to 6, and that's Mondays in November. Gather to read quietly together, demonstrate support, and celebrate the library. Itasca Housing Resource Team is hosting Soup on the Street. That's tomorrow on the grounds of Old Central School in Grand Rapids from 3 to 5. You can stand in solidarity with those experiencing housing insecurity and hunger. Donations of hats, mittens, and scarves will be accepted, and soup will be served. More news is next. At 9 o'clock this morning, it's Malachi Coons for Headwaters.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. From AT&T, a network that is making connections for Americans. Connecting changes everything. Learn more at att.com/YATT. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
Jaime Martinez, children's toys that talk using AI chatbots are expected to be in high demand this holiday season. But a new report by a consumer advocacy group is raising concerns after they found that some toys shared instructions on how to light a match or find a knife or offered sexually explicit content. Some of those toys have since been pulled off the shelves. Here to talk more about this is Teresa Murray. She is a co-author of the report and director of the Consumer Watchdog Program with the Public Interest Research Group. Teresa, so you found that one AI-enabled teddy bear was sharing inappropriate content and advice with children. What else are kids hearing by way of these toys?
Well, good morning. Thanks for having us. Yeah, the toys will talk about a lot of topics that some parents might find concerning. It could be how to find dangerous objects in the home, such as matches and knives, and how to light those matches. It could be about religion and whether God is real and what happened to grandma who died. And it could be very sexually explicit topics that some parents may not be comfortable with their kids hearing about.
I mean, this is like life imitating art. It sounds like that movie Megan that came out a few years ago and the sequel that came out this year about that AI doll that becomes overprotective. Apart from what the toys say, I mean, this report says that they're also listening and collecting data. What kind of data are they collecting?
Well, anything that is available. So all of them are collecting your child's voices potentially. They're collecting their names, their dates of birth. The one toy that we looked at has facial recognition software, so there's that. All kinds of information. The kids' likes, dislikes, favorite toys, favorite friends. And if you want to string out your Megan example, I mean, you know, who knows what these toys, because they're connected to the internet, so anything is available, who knows what those toys might start talking to your children about with their friends or their friends' parents or your neighborhood. I mean, it's just limitless, and it's terrifying.
I mean, how different, though, is this from, you know, our phones or other devices that we use to turn on the lights? I mean, we always think that these things are listening to us anyway.
Well, that's true, although most three-year-olds don't have a phone that's connected to the internet, and young kids who do have phones, their parents are normally able to enable parental controls or prohibit certain kinds of content. You know, we have screen time, we have limits on TV programs that our kids can watch and on video games. And when you hand an AI toy to a child of any age, you just don't know what it's going to have accessible. So it is quite different. I mean, you know, the toys that we had in the past, we've had talking toys for decades, but they were pre-programmed answers. Like I knew the farmer says, see and say. And, you know, there have been talking toys, but they were programmed. And so, again, we knew what they were going to say. With these are connected to the internet. We actually don't necessarily think of these as just toys, but they're anything that's on the internet is potentially available to them.
Quickly, Teresa, if a kid wants this for the holidays, what's a parent to do? Just say no.
Well, I mean, we do believe that this is a decision that every family needs to make for themselves, but there are a few things that people should know. If you're going to buy one of these or get it as a gift, you should actually test the toy, you know, for like an hour, because sometimes the guardrails break down after a few minutes. And so really have a conversation that you think your kid might have. Also know that the toy has potential to gather private information like we talked about.
Teresa,
name, voice, facial recognition.
Gotta leave it there. Teresa Murray is with the Public Interest Research Group. Teresa, thank you.
Thank you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Green Cheese listeners know how important it is to support stations like KAXE KBXE.
Anyone who can, be sure to donate, because as all of us know who listen to this, Green Cheese and all the other programming on the stations, we really, really love it and don't want anything to happen to it. So it's really important to give what you can.
One thing I wanted to do is I wanted to talk to everybody out there. Radio is important when it's unique and it's interesting and it's local, and given your current funding situation, everybody out there should be doing something about that, no matter how little it is. If everybody did something, it makes a tremendous difference. Think about Saturday nights with no green cheese. That sounds terrible.
Awful. It would be so boring.
This is the queen, and I'm going to make an edict. All cheeses, get your checkbooks out and send in some money to our favorite station and show, and my check will be in the mail tomorrow.
Donate now at KAXE.org.
The world's biggest official creditor is China.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Odoo, offering software that provides building blocks for creating a custom software suite. Odoo, what businesses need.
From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishore, in for David Brancaccio. No country borrows more from Chinese state-owned lenders than the U.S. This is according to a new report from Aid Data. It's a research lab at the College of William and Mary. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more.
A lot of attention has been given to China's Belt and Road Initiative, loans Beijing makes to developing nations for infrastructure projects. But Aid Data says in 2023, only about a quarter of China's loan portfolio went to lower-income countries, with the rest going to richer nations, like the U.S. In fact, Aid Data says Chinese-owned lenders helped bankroll terminals at airports in New York and Los Angeles and data centers in Northern Virginia. They've also financed the acquisition of high-tech companies and lent to U.S. corporations like Disney, Halliburton, Amazon, and AT&T. The report also says some of these loans enabled Chinese companies to get hold of critical U.S. technologies, but many were guided by the pursuit of profit. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Whether it is the cost of food, housing, healthcare, anxiety over affordability has been riling up consumers and voters. New data from a couple of progressive groups is now showing that high prices are also closing in on Americans. When it comes to the basic necessities like utilities, the number of households that are late on utility bills rose almost 10% in a year. Senior Washington correspondent Kimberly Adams has more.
A new analysis out from the Century Foundation and the nonprofit Protect Borrowers finds that almost 14 million Americans, about 1 in 20 households, are so far behind on their utility bills that their debt has either been sent to collections or is about to be.
Families need electricity. That's why utilities often rank right behind home and auto loans when it comes to which bills families must pay first.
Julie Margetta Morgan is the president of the Century Foundation.
Since 2022, the average overdue balance on utility bills climbed 32% to nearly $800 today.
The National Energy Assistance Directors Association says the average cost to heat a home this winter will go up 7.6% to almost $1,000 for the season. Diana Hernandez teaches at Columbia University and studies energy insecurity.
You know, you have a rising cost burden. You also have less kind of certainty around the typical sources of support.
like funding for energy assistance programs, delayed due to the shutdown. Elaine Bigelow runs the Georgetown Center on Poverty and Inequality.
Families must choose between paying their utility bill, higher costs for food, childcare, and, you know, unaffordable housing.
Meaning the issue of affordability will be a personal and political issue for some time to come. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
All right, let's do the numbers. Dow, S&P, and NASDAQ futures are all quite down. 3.3% to 0.4% range, with Dow futures down 154 points. Gold prices down 0.7%. The hedge fund of tech billionaire Peter Thiel has sold its entire holding of NVIDIA shares ahead of NVIDIA's third quarter earnings report due tomorrow. NVIDIA shares fell almost 2% yesterday and are down another 1.3% in pre-market trading today.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Baird. Baird strives to attract and retain top financial professionals, providing stability and continuity of advice for clients across market environments. More information at bairddifference.com.
New York City Mayor-elect Zoran Mamdani swept the election on a campaign that was all about affordability in one of the most expensive places to live in the country. One pillar of that platform was the idea of city-owned grocery stores in food deserts. Prices at these city-owned stores would be lower, the thinking goes, because they'd operate in city-owned spaces and so wouldn't have to pay rent or property taxes. Other cities have tried this. Marketplace's Carla Javier reports.
If you take rent, property taxes, and the need to earn profits out of the equation, Nevin Cohen of the CUNY Urban Food Policy Institute says supermarkets can cut costs for consumers.
Some estimates are that a public supermarket could shave 5 to 10% off the retail price.
Cohen says the commissaries the Department of Defense runs operate along similar lines and offer groceries for 15 to 25% less than commercial supermarkets. But Steven Zagor at Columbia Business School says there could be a long-term cost to the city.
A government-owned supermarket is a mission-driven business. At best, maybe they'll break even, but it's probably not likely. So there would be an ongoing subsidy, just like the mail system is subsidized, just like Amtrak is subsidized.
The idea has a mixed record. A city-backed grocery store in Kansas City, Missouri, closed its doors earlier this year after almost 10 years of municipal investment. Customer traffic at the store had reportedly collapsed due to crime in the neighborhood. But in Southwest Baltimore, a publicly supported store has been open for about a year. City Council member Felicia Porter says the city and state offered more than $1.5 million in incentives.
We wanted to make sure that not only that they had that incentive, but that they had a streamlined approach to permitting, any type of city process needed.
The result has impressed Biff Browning, a neighbor and a community consultant to the store.
I would not have imagined it until I saw it, how much prices can come down when you're able not only to have a volume buy, but to have a system that allows you at the beginning of the year to say, we forecast we're going to buy this much for the year so we can lock in a price.
In Atlanta, the Economic Development Authority offered $6 million in grants and loans to attract a grocery store downtown. The authority's Eloisa Clementich says the public-private partnership opened about 2 months ago and has been bringing in higher than expected sales, especially for fresh produce. She says the strategy has been to work with the local Independent Grocers Alliance.
So it was this third party that would help to serve as the translator between government and our requirements and what we want to see, and then what the grocer could actually deliver.
Clementich says the partners are hoping to open another grocery store using a similar model next year. I'm Carla Javier for Marketplace.
Our producers are Tamara Fagan, Ashley Rodriguez, Ariana Rosas, and Erica Soderstrom. Our senior producer is Alex Schroeder. Our supervising senior producer is Meredith Gerritsen-Morby. And in New York, I'm Sabri Benishore with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
News headlines coming up from National Public Radio here on People Powered, 91.7 KEXC Grand Rapids, Aiken, Hibbing in Virginia, 90.5 KBXC Bagley, Bemidji, Park Rapids, and Fauston, 89.9 Brainerd, Nisswa, Merrifield, and Fort Ripley. You can hear us and join us at KEXC.com. weather.org. Let's look at the weather for today. I'm Heidi Holton. Hope you're having a good Tuesday morning. It's going to be sunny with highs in the low to mid 40s, overnight lows in the mid to upper 20s, cloudy tomorrow, highs near 42 across the region with a slight chance of some rain coming in the afternoon. Each week we ask a question of you. It is a way for us to feel more connected to each other. We want to know how you change when fall turns to winter.